Du lytter til Investering på Hjernen, en podcast om investering og det, der foregår i hovedet, når du investerer. Jeg har talt en del om risikoprofil her i Investering på Hjernen. Det er fordi, det er utrolig vigtigt at starte med at få den afklaret. Hvordan skal du investere afhænger af, hvordan din risikoprofil den er. Men din risikoprofil, sådan som den føles i dag, den kan være anderledes, end den føles i morgen, fordi vi bliver påvirket af, hvad der sker på markederne. Vi bliver påvirket af vores erfaring med at investere. Vi bliver påvirket af rigtig mange forskellige ting. Så hvordan får man afklaret sin risikoprofil for det langsigtede, når vi bliver påvirket af det kortsigtede? Det har jeg prøvet at tale med Greg Davis om. Prøv at høre med her. This time on Investment on the Brain, we will be speaking in English as well, because I have an English guest. He might already be known by my listeners, because I have mentioned him beforehand. Welcome, Greg Davis.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm very happy that you are attending. First of all, we need to get to know you a little better. So I have this thing I call the quick round. Just a few questions. Coffee or tea?
Coffee.
But you're English. when you
grew up in South Africa.
Oh, okay. That might explain it. So if you're reading, is it fiction or non-fiction?
Both.
Both, yes. If you're done with your dinner, what takes your attention after that? Netflix or do you exercise?
I try and do the exercise earlier in the day, so Netflix.
Okay, so you have time for Netflix in the evening.
Yeah.
So do you exercise before, in the morning, or...?
I'm not a very good morning person, no. So I tend to work in the morning and then exercise at around lunchtime or just before lunch. Take a break and get some exercise, 11-ish.
Okay, and then go back to work.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds like a good idea to move the body midday.
Easier to do in lockdown when we were all at home.
Yes, I can bet you. So which do you prefer, dog or cat?
Ooh, I have both. I like them both for different reasons. But
but which one do you like the most?
I'll go for dog. We got a puppy at the moment.
Oh, that takes it all. I mean,
yeah.
And I've been told, or I read somewhere, that we have this special thing in our brain for these animal eyes and the way they are acting. So, of course, the puppy wins.
Difficult to stay grumpy with a puppy around.
Yeah, true. Okay, when you are investing, is it short or long term?
There's no such thing as short term investing.
There is? No, not with the investing behind, that's what you mean. So you're not speculating?
No, investing.
Long-term. You are investing, yes. High or low risk?
High. Well, we can talk about that. High risk with a safety net.
High risk with the safety net. Okay, so what's the safety net like?
Well, I think people who take risk can only take risk if they've done preparation and they've built up a buffer. So you first set aside the money to secure your immediate future, and you do your homework, and then with what's left, you take high risk.
Okay. We might get back to that when we talk about risk tolerance. So how do you invest? Is it stock picking or investment funds?
Investment funds, mostly passive ETFs.
Passive ETFs. Okay. Keeping the costs down?
Yeah.
Okay. That was the quick round.
Du lytter til Investering på Hjernen med Jens Bælle.
Now we know a little bit about you, but we need to know a little more. What is your background, Greg?
As you heard before, my coffee loving, I grew up in South Africa, but I've been in the UK for the last 20 years. I started as an economist, as a traditional economist with a kind of side interest in philosophy. I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up, and I finished university, so I became a management consultant because it seemed to be a bit of everything and not much of anything. And interestingly, my first project ever was in Copenhagen.
Really?
It was great.
Yes.
What was then Danske Bank, but is now Danske Bank.
Yeah.
So I spent a year in Copenhagen consulting, and then decided I had unfinished business in academia. So I went back to university to do my PhD. And my intention was to go to philosophy and study rationality. And I was reading to figure out what my PhD proposal was going to be. And I stumbled across this field of behavioral economics and behavioral finance, which had a little bit of philosophy in it, and it's all about rationality and what's not rationality. It had a little bit of economics, which was my background. It seemed this wonderful mix of practical and theoretical together. But it had psychology in it, which I had no background at all. So it gave me a chance to pick up something new as well. And I thought, wow, this is it. This is just the perfect thing. And I swung my proposal around to focus on behavioral finance. So studying financial decision making and how we can predict it and how we can understand the decisions that people make. Then after a few years of PhD, I went back into the commercial world, and in 2006, joined Barclays. Yes. To set up what at the time was the world's first dedicated team of behavioral finance geeks inside a bank. And I ran that team plus the quant team for Barclays Wealth for the next 10 years until 2016.
So you had the behavioral and then you had the quant team as well?
Yeah. And that's fairly unusual, but I think is quite important, because there is this sense that behavioral finance kind of denies all of classical finance and it needs to be in opposition to it. And I don't think that's useful. The two need to work together. We need to understand the traditional models and how to measure risk and all the quanti stuff. And then we need to understand the behavioral stuff that stops us from making good decisions. And if we bring it together, we do much better than either on their own.
I like that idea, yeah. Because often the truth is in the middle. On the sides with where the opposition are, and that goes for this as well, because there's a lot of good things in economics. Yep. And there's a lot of good things in financial behavior, but then it's triangle if you add in the philosophy. Yep. Which I think is quite interesting as well.
It is, and I think, you know, the philosophers of course have studied rationality for centuries, and a lot of that literature has been somewhat ignored, I think, by both the psychologists and the economists.
Yes.
And it is important to blend these things, because when you get out of the academic world and you start trying to do it in practice, what I always say that we're doing, and by we, by the way, the last step in my story is I left Barclays. I now run a fintech technology, finance technology company, and we build behavioral ideas into software to help people make better financial decisions. So digital coaches and profiling tools and that sort of thing. But what I always say that we do is we design things to help people make better financial decisions. And of course, that's very behavioral. It's about emotions and decision-making, etc. But it also requires you to have a fairly good idea of what better means. And that's where classical finance theory comes from, because it gives us this template to say, all right, you're human, you're imperfect, you're never going to get here. But assuming you were completely rational, here's a template of what you should be aiming for. And that's why I think both of them amplify each other, the traditional and the behavioral.
Yes, I think that is true. So you already explained why you went into behavioral, so I can skip that question. The philosophy and the economy, I like that. So let's go to the topic of the day, or we have three of them. Risk tolerance is something very interesting to get to know your own risk tolerance, and as an advisor to know the true risk tolerance of your clients, and mm-hmm. not imposing your own risk tolerance on your clients, which can often happen.
Yeah.
So why is it that you think that risk tolerance is also so important to figure out?
Because if you are, as an advisor, building for someone a portfolio that, again, going back to long-term investing, that they are going to need to have to hold on to, maybe tweak and adapt, but by and large, this is going to be the core of their solution for investing for the next, not few months, for the next 10, 15, 20 years. You have to anchor it on something, and you have to anchor it on, in the end, how much risk are you willing to take of outcomes? How much chance of a worse downside outcome are you willing to take on for the chance of a better upside outcome? Mm-hmm. And that willingness to take risk is essentially risk tolerance. And it's almost like the anchoring point for everything else in advice. It's the star to steer by. So if I have got your long-term risk tolerance wrong, I am building for you a portfolio that's anchored on the wrong level of risk. And I'm likely asking you to sit with that, or roughly that, for the next 10, 15, or 20 years. And that can make a vast difference to your ability to withstand, emotionally withstand the journey over that time, but also your ability to find your future life goals, et cetera, et cetera. So it's really important. It's only one piece of many. It's by no means the only thing that matters. But it's just a really important anchoring point around which you can build all the other stuff when you're deciding what is the right answer that I should be trying to approach as an investor. Hmm.
Du kan lære mere om investorpsykologi i bogen Når Hulemænd Investerer af Jens Balle. Find den på averagejoe.dk eller i din boghandel. As the markets change, isn't it often so that our risk tolerance changes, or at least how we feel about risk change? When the markets are going good, we like more risk, and then when they fall, which they often will do, we don't like risk. Isn't it always so?
So it is, but here is where we need to be quite careful. So we would make a distinction between risk tolerance, which is your willingness to trade off long-term risk and return if you are being relatively cool, calm, and collected. And that is pretty stable. That's your stable core. It's, if you like, your baseline risk tolerance. Now,
calm and collected.
Cool, calm, and collected. If you're, you know, all of the context effects and the framing and the behavioral angst of what I've read in the newspaper this morning, if I strip all of that away and I just ask, in 15 years, what risk return trade-off am I prepared to or willing to absorb? That's pretty stable if you measure it right. That is unlikely on any given day to be how you feel about taking risk that morning. And so we've got these two different things. The long-term stable core of your risk tolerance, which is what we should be foundationally building a portfolio on, and how you feel about risk day to day, which, as you say, fluctuates up and down depending on, I don't know, the weather and how nice your breakfast was and what you've read in the newspaper and what your portfolio has been doing for the last week and all of this context stuff. And both of them are important. But if I base your 20-year portfolio on how you feel this morning, now, it just may be that this morning you're in a nervous state about something and I end up locking you into a very low-risk 80% bond portfolio for the next 20 years. Very bad idea. Or maybe this morning you had a great day and it's really sunny and you're feeling I could just roll the dice and I lock you into something for the next 20 years that you're going to just be miserable with. So we need to be careful to distinguish long-term risk tolerance from short-term risk behavior or risk attitudes.
Yes.
And in the work that we do, we can measure your psychological proclivity to these two things separately. So the long-term one we call risk tolerance. And part of the issue here is a lot of people use the word risk tolerance to mean many different things. But if we call that one the long-term one risk tolerance, and the short-term one is your composure. It's your ability to withstand the ups and downs and the vagaries of the news that comes in at you and on a day-to-day basis.
Yes. So you have a tool that can derive the two of them.
Yes, plus many others. So
yes, of course.
At the core of a lot of what we do is we use psychometric approaches to measure multiple aspects of people's financial personality. And classical finance theory only has space for one thing about you, and that's your long-term risk tolerance.
Yes.
But of course, when you invest, all sorts of other things come into play. You know, how familiar does this asset feel to me? How anxious do I feel about the markets today? Am I a confident investor? Your level of confidence. So all these other things influence your behavior, and classical finance theory just doesn't have any space for them. So we need to find ways of bringing them in to how we advise people, of using them as an overlay to here's the right answer for you, now go and invest in it.
So your model is not just built around what I see as a classical question when I'm talking about risks with clients. What would you do if the market drops 15%? Would you A, buy more? Would you C, wait and see? Or, that was B. And, or would you C, sell the rest?
Yeah.
You have more than that in it.
Absolutely terrible question to ask people. And if any advisors out there are currently asking that question of your clients, then come and talk to us at Oxford Risk and we'll give you a better version. But the reason it's terrible is...
I'm pretty sure you just... Google banks, Denmark, and then you have a potential client list lying ready for waiting for you.
Excellent. There's many reasons why it's a bad question, but the most fundamental one is most people simply don't know the answer to that question. I might think, I'm a pretty calm, stable person. Markets will drop. I know I'm a long-term investor. I'll stick with it. And then you find yourself in that moment. And it's a completely different story. And even if you think, you know what? I lived through the financial crisis of 08, 09, so I know how I would behave. Emotionally, you've largely forgotten that. And so people simply don't know the answer to that question of how would you feel if you suddenly lost 20, 10, 30, whatever percent of your wealth. The other reason it's a bad question is throwing percentages at people tends to result in very unstable numbers, and it tends often to be more a measure of people's numeracy, how good they are with numbers, than actually of their risk tolerance. So we try and avoid all those sorts of questions. And what we're looking for is very simple statements that we can put in front of people. And you just ask, do you agree or disagree to these statements? And I'll just use a very simplistic one. If you go, I am a financial risk taker. Do you strongly agree, strongly disagree to that statement? And anyone can answer that question. They don't have to think about numbers or percentages or future. And it sounds very simplistic, but if you combine in a tool a number of those questions together and you form a consolidated score, and then you can compare it to data from tens of thousands of people answering that same question all around the world, and you can correct for age and gender and all these things, then you have a very stable idea of where people sit, where this person sits relative to the rest of humanity in terms of their willingness to take long-term risk.
Very interesting. So it's sort of like when you apply for a job and you have a personality profile made out, because the questions are almost the same. They don't ask you, are you a psychopath? They ask you other questions, and then they find out that you're a psychopath.
Yes.
And that's sort of what you're doing.
Very similar. And, the important thing is using robust academic techniques to analyze the data and building it on lots of data. So you can't just, we don't make these questions up. We don't choose them because we like them. We choose them because the statistics tell us that this combination of questions provides a reliable measure that will sift people apart in terms of whether they are very low, medium low, high, very high risk tolerance.
Is that part of what you call financial personality?
Yes.
Then the result that you get, is that a corner or is it the whole explanation of your financial personality?
No, so we now have measures of up to 20 different dimensions or variables of financial personality. And risk tolerance is only one of them.
Okay.
It's an important one for the reasons that we covered earlier. And it's an important one to get right because, not least because the regulators require you to get it right. And, you quite reasonably could be sued by your clients as an advisor if you didn't get it right. Mm-hmm. But it's only a very small part of the story. So I might fix this, your risk tolerance, let's say your medium high, I map that to an asset allocation and a risk level, and we can do all of that stuff. And I've got this star to steer by. This is where I'm aiming for you over the long term. Now what I have to do is also understand your composure, your impulsivity, your familiarity bias, all these other behavioral things, because what they do, risk tolerance tells me, here's the right thing for you to aim for. All the other dimensions tell me how you as an individual are reluctant to aim for them. How you, if we think of it as a journey, you're in a boat, and risk tolerance tells me where you're going. Risk capacity, which is about your financial circumstances right now, that tells me where you're coming from right now. All the other stuff, the composure and the other behavioral stuff, tells me how likely you are to jump overboard before you get there. And it's really important to understand that, because most investors fail to get good long-term outcomes, not because they don't know what the right portfolio for them looks like, but because they don't stick with it when markets drop, or they get too excited and they buy something else when a friend tells them that, you know, reverse triple leverage Bitcoin ETFs are the thing to buy this week.
Mm, yeah, so let's go
for
that.
We get emotionally excited or fearful of things, yes, and they cause us to jump out of the boat, even if the boat is the right thing for us to be in.
Du lytter til Investering på Hjernen. Husk at abonnere, så du ikke går glip af et afsnit.
I have a memory, and now I'm going to find out if it's correct, that when you were at Barclays, you had a blog or something where you wrote that you also tried to tell the clients how often they should look at their investments. Is that part of that impulsivity or the composure?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think probably the key thing there is composure. In general, I think it's fair to say that most people, well, a large proportion of people look at their investments too much because they think, I'm invested, I better stay aware, I better stay on top of it, I'm not doing my job right unless I watch it. And if you are an investor with a 10-year horizon, you're a long-term investor, and you look at your portfolio every week, that week-to-week information is not just useless to steal your portfolio, it's actually harmful. Yes. Because what it does is it drives short-term emotional responses that tempt you to veer off course. So particularly low composure people who have a higher emotional engagement with the here and now, with the journey, they would do better to look at the portfolio much less frequently and at a much higher level.
And that's what you said at Barclays back
yeah.
then. Yes.
It's not universally true though, because people who are high composure, they have the opposite problem. They maybe are just too comfortable. They never bother to look at their portfolio. They never think about whether it's the right thing for them. Things happen to the portfolio. They don't rebalance. They don't correct course. And so for some people out there, actually what you want to do is you want to nudge them and prod them into looking at their portfolio a little bit more often, because otherwise their solution and their reality start to diverge over time. So in all of this behavioral investing, the right thing to do differs from person to person to person, depending on their unique financial personality signature.
Mm. I find that very interesting, and I'm going to ask you if I'm normal when I'm doing this. See, I have a long-term strategy. I'm not that old. I'm older than when I made out the strategy, and for some reason, I just decided to have all equities in my portfolio, and I did that the beginning of the 2000s. I made that decision right after the .com and everything. And it was very nice for a couple of years. Then came the other crisis with the financial institutions and everything. And I kept my plan. Mm-hmm. And then in March of 2009, I was very, very worried. And of course, I'm working as a financial professional. Or at least I'm getting paid as one. I don't know if I was working as one, but I was getting paid as one. And I was looking at the markets every day because I had to do that. I had clients that were pissed off because they lost money. I had the whole company were disillusionized because everything was going so bad. So, of course, it also hit me. And I was thinking, why are you doing this? Why don't you invest into different things? Why don't we have some bonds as well? But then I got busy that day and I didn't change it. And actually afterwards, in March 2009, that was the lowest for the equities.
Yeah.
I didn't change. Maybe it was a little bit by chance.
Yeah.
Is it that emotion that you talk about that we can be hit by? I mean, if we look too often.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, what you're talking about there, it sounds like you as an individual are a high composer individual because you managed to stick with these equities all the way through that. But even a high composer individual, when you hit March 2009, is going to be stressed. And when you're in that environment, you're talking to, as you say, your colleagues or your clients, or It is very easy for every single person you meet in that environment to tell you a very convincing, very articulate story about why it's going to keep getting worse. Mm. And you know, these are all intelligent people who've read. And when you're faced with this wall of negativity, and it's articulate negativity, people are, you know, it sounds very plausible. Even then, a high composure person, it's very difficult for you to stick to your guns. And I find it very interesting that you said maybe by accident, because actually, one of the best ways of, I think, overcoming the emotional temptation for a knee-jerk response, to buy, to sell, whatever it may be, is a pause point. Hmm. If you can find a way of going, okay, I've decided I'm going to sell, I've panicked, I'm going to do it, but I'll just wait 12 hours until tomorrow morning and see how I feel. And maybe the next morning you still panic and you still want to sell. But very often what it does is it just creates this emotional distance between you when you're really worried and making the decision and you the next morning. And that is true of all sorts of things in decision making. If you can deliberately engineer a break point in your decisions, the emotional content of your decisions will go down on average, and the quality of your decisions will go up. And this might sound rather strange, but you know, I was in a similar position to you. I worked in a bank. Everyone's surrounded by things flashing red, and it's terrifying. And it was not my job to watch the markets, but I could see all this information coming in, and it was very, very nerve-wracking. And sometime later I have what I call my investment constitution. It's a set of rules that I force myself to follow. And one of my rules is I now never, ever, ever allow myself to make an investment decision during the week. I only ever decide what to buy or sell in my portfolio on a weekend. Mm-hmm. Because only on a weekend do I have the time and the space and the emotional, I don't know, calm to think about things right. And even then, when I decide to make that decision, and I can even plug the decision into the trading software and I can push buy, it doesn't go live until Monday morning. So I've got the opportunity to change my mind. Yeah. And yeah, maybe I miss out on some turning points and this, that, and the other. But on average, I think it makes me a better investor because I'm not investing emotionally anymore. I'm investing according to the plan.
Yeah. Sounds like a very good plan. Very good. I'm still sticking to the all equity thing that I'm doing.
You've done rather well over that 20 plus year period then.
Yeah, it's been pretty good. Yeah, sure. And it's my pension, so it's very, very long term. I don't do it with everything that I invest, but I do it with my pension scheme.
Du lytter til Investering på Hjernen. Find alle de gamle episoder i din favorit podcast afspiller eller se mere på investeringpohjernen.dk.
Okay, so we are as humans, and that might not shock everybody, but we are very complex, and we are touched by what happens right now, and it affects what we think also in the long term. I think that is very, very interesting. And sometimes that also leads us to not being invested or failing to invest, as you call it.
Yeah.
What's the issue with that?
I actually think that for most people, the biggest behavioral cost is not what you do when you invest. It's the fact that you don't invest at all, or you invest too little, or you take too little risk. Because one of the most emotionally difficult things for people to do in investing is to take money from somewhere safe, my savings account, and put it somewhere that, at least in the short term, feels very risky. It feels like a negative emotional trade-off. I'm going from safe to risky. Now, if you play out 10 years in the future, actually the trade-off is the other way around. The risky thing is sitting in cash because you lose value with inflation and actually
that hasn't been a thing in for many years, but now it's a thing again.
Yeah,
with the inflation.
Absolutely, and even without inflation, your foregone returns. If you said forget about inflation,
yes.
If you're in a moderate risk multi-asset class, I'm not trying to do anything too clever. I'm just buying some ETFs, and maybe I'm a 60% equities, 40% bonds. Over a 20-year period, if you look at your average annual lost returns from sitting in a bank account versus that, it's about 4.5 to 5% per year. Mm. Now, you give up 5% per year over 20 years, And that's a huge amount of money you have forgone.
Yeah.
And there's, I think, a very important point here, because people often say, well, investing, it's like the casino, right? It's gambling, you can't predict anything. It is, but there's one very important difference. If you go into a casino, the advantage is on the side of the house. It's on the side of the casino. So you know on average over long periods of time, you're going to lose and the house is going to win. In investing, you are the casino. Over long periods of time, if you sit on cash and don't invest, you're going to lose. Whereas if long periods of time, where if you get invested, assuming that you've got your safety net, you are the house. So it's very costly not to invest money that you should and could invest over long periods of time. And it's an almost entirely emotional and behavioral thing. It's because people are either nervous about the complexity, they're daunted by the risk. We all make decisions in the short term, and in the short term, moving money from somewhere safe to somewhere risky is a very emotionally uncomfortable thing to do. So that cost of reluctance means that very many people around the world never invest at all, except maybe in their pension. So the money, they just build up money in the bank account. Mm-hmm. And that, by the way, has become an even bigger issue through COVID, as many people have built up savings and that there is uninvested. If they do invest, they probably don't invest in enough. They don't invest a high enough proportion, so too much is in the savings account. And if they do invest, often they're perhaps not taking enough risk. And this is where it comes to this thing I said earlier about the safety net is, you know, we sort of think about people as being on a spectrum from low risk tolerance to high risk tolerance. And that's a complete description of them. Actually, what all of us should be is we should have a low risk tolerance piece of us that ensures our lives to make sure that we've built this safety net. And that buys us the ticket to go and take more risk with the rest. But what instead you find people do is they self-insure, they build up too much cash, and then they take too little risk with the remainder, and you end up giving up returns at every corner.
Yes. And that is actually, in my opinion, somewhere where you mix very much the economist and the behavioral, because the knowledge of risk is rewarded, and over time, how much it costs, that's the economist in you speaking.
Yes.
Whereas you are trying to imply it on the behaviors of us people. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think, you know, you can look at this as everyone thinks about risk and reward, but there is something else that all of us need, which is comfort, emotional comfort. And what tends to happen is, because we make decisions in the present, we shy away from things that make us feel uncomfortable, like putting money from the savings account to the investment account. What we're effectively doing is we're buying for ourselves emotional comfort, but we're doing it really expensively, because sitting on my money in cash for 20 years at 5% lost returns a year is a really expensive way of getting to sleep better at night. So what we need to do, classical finance would say, ignore your need for emotional comfort. It's stupid, it's irrational. I would say that's completely untrue. I mean, there's nothing irrational about wanting to sleep at night, right?
No, no.
The question is, how do I sleep at night more cheaply? How do I get that comfort I need without the really expensive strategy of underinvesting? And then, you know, you start to get to a sensible thing. Maybe taking a little less risk than would be financially ideal for me buys me enough emotional comfort to stick in the market. You know, you went in at 100% equities, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But maybe if you were just a little lower composure, you would go, okay, rationally you want to do 100% equities, but why don't we just buy you some emotional insurance by leaving 10 or 15% in cash? And maybe for you, that'll cost you a little bit of money over time, but maybe for you that insurance is worth paying for, because it stops you shooting yourself in the foot along the journey.
Mm, exactly. Yeah, I understand what you mean. But the low investment participation and the low risk that we tend to do, couldn't that also be something that comes from our advisors? Because the advisor, as you said before, they have to figure out the right risk tolerance, or else they can be fined by the authorities.
Yeah.
So if they make it a little lower, that might be nicer for them. Also, if you are an advisor and you have a portfolio of clients, and if they get mad at you because you gave a bad investment advice and leave you, well, that's not nice. So you give them fewer investment advice and with lower risks.
Yeah.
Is that anything that you've looked into, or?
Yeah, I think that is true. I mean, obviously, the best advice always involves encouraging people to do something a little bit uncomfortable, because if it didn't, they would be doing it anyway, right? So an advisor should be slightly pushing the boundaries of what a client would do naturally for themselves. But it's always easier to pull back a little bit, because you don't want to have too many tough conversations. And you know that markets are going to go down at some point, right? So and that can be true. Now, I should say, I don't think this is certainly not true of all advisors. There are some advisors who might do that, and there are some who won't. What I think is interesting here, we ran, in the last couple of years, two large-scale sort of pieces of research with advisors that we called noise audits. Now, the noise audit, this is Daniel Kahneman, Nobel Prize winner, father of behavioral economics. Last year, he and Cass Sunstein and Olivier Simoni wrote this book, Noise.
Yes.
And the idea of noise is, it's not necessarily about behavioral bias. The idea of noise is, if I go to a doctor, I want to find out what's wrong with me. And if I go to 200 doctors, I don't want 200 different answers. I want them all to give me the same diagnosis about what's wrong with me, because that's the problem I'm trying to solve. And in the same way, if I go to a financial advisor, pretty much they should all be giving me roughly the same solution after they have considered my financial personality and my financial circumstances,
exactly,
et cetera.
Exactly, yeah.
What we observe, both for doctors and for financial advisors, is absolutely not that. The lottery of what advice you get, depending on which advisor you happen to go and see, is enormous. Mm-hmm. To the extent where when we put case studies in front of 300 advisors and we said, here's all the information that you roughly need to establish what's the right risk level for this client. One of the questions we asked was, what's the right equity proportion,
yes,
for this client given their age and their circumstances and their risk tolerance and all of that? Mm. For every single example client we gave to these advisors, and I think we used 7 different case studies, every single one of them, these hundreds of advisors, their recommended equity allocation ranged from 10% to 100% for the same client situation. So the advisors are also beset with all sorts of behavioral biases. And
yeah.
I mean, and the one that you mentioned isn't really even a behavioral bias. It's a perfectly rational thing for me to do as an advisor, is to pull back on risk slightly because it makes my life easier.
Yeah.
We do need to be very cautious about this. Can we overcome, not only as a client, but as an advisor, our own emotional tendencies to reach for the slightly more comfortable thing rather than the right thing?
Du lytter til Investering på Hjernen med Jens Bale.
But there was a pattern, as I recall, that because I read about it, older advisors, they were more risky in their advising, I think, was one of the patterns, or something like that. But is there a perfect picture of an advisor that you should look for when you go to look for an advisor?
I don't think so. I mean, I think what is very important in advice is you want the advisor to know what they're doing, right? So there's a certain skill and experience that is a baseline you want.
Yes, yes.
But you also want an advisor with whom you have good rapport. And that isn't anything about the advice they give. It's about how you match with them. Because to follow advice, you have to accept the advice. And to accept the advice, you have to have a connection with the person who's giving it to you. So that can be very, very idiosyncratic. However, I think it is probably worth saying that an advisor who is slightly higher composure than you might be a good idea. Because you want the advisor to steer you towards the long term.
Yes.
You know, it should be the client calling the advisor in a panic rather than the advisor calling the client in a panic most of the time. And we do see that on average, advisors do tend to have, their client population, of course, is very broad because it's drawn from the whole human population. Advisors have spent time in the markets. They come from, you know, a narrower field of backgrounds, et cetera. They've studied the same thing, et cetera. So they tend to be higher risk tolerance than clients on average. They tend to be higher composure they tend to be higher confidence. And all of these things are good to a degree. Although one interesting thing though is confidence. what a client wants is an advisor who can tell them with great confidence what to do and why and what's going to happen in the world next. And yet, the more accurate an advisor is about their own knowledge of the future, the more they should be willing to say, I don't know. So there's this inherent tension that really the best advisors are the ones that the clients don't very much like, because they say, I don't know a lot, or we don't know what the future holds. I don't know what you should do.
Yeah, you won't like them as a client,
exactly.
But they might be the best.
Yeah,
because they're not, don't have high belief in them, their own advice. And maybe there's a business model waiting for you to discover here, because you could maybe have the employees at advisors taking your test, and then they can have that as a information to potential clients that here's Glenn, he tends to have a high composure and he goes into panic very easily. Please bear that in mind when he calls you.
Or, we have done that actually, and I've some of the advisors that I have seen use financial personality of their clients best are the ones who are also willing to put in front of the clients, here is my financial personality. And I'm not going to give you, Mr. and Mrs. Client, I'm not going to give you the same portfolio I give me, because we are different people, and here's how and here's why. So that can be, but it requires a certain amount of transparency and humility on the part of the advisor.
And that's tough to find. Well, thank you very much, Greg, for talking to me about the risk tolerance, the financial personality, and also a little about failing to invest. I like those topics very much. I have some final questions for you. Mm-hmm. Because what is your own best or worst investment that you ever made? What was your best?
I really, really don't like this question, because what I would like to answer to you is the best investment I ever made was the well-constructed portfolio that I built up using all these principles, etc. But frankly, I many years ago decided to move away from renting and bought a house, because my son was one and it was that time of life, etc. And I bought it at a completely accidentally good time in the London property market. So financially, my best investment has been the house. Mm. But I would, the thing about property is it's an asset that is enormously concentrated, completely indivisible, not movable. So in many respects, it's a bad financial asset. Just sometimes, accidentally, it turns into a good financial asset. And because it makes up such a large portion of people's investable wealth, often it can turn into the best investment.
And you might have leverage in it as well.
And I think that is an interesting point, because there is a big distinction, I think, between buying a house on a mortgage with a leverage and buying a house out of money. So imagine I had £1 million sitting in the bank account. Would I buy property with that? No, absolutely not. I would buy a diversified portfolio that is probably, in my case, I'm not quite as gung-ho as you, but let's say 80 to 90% equities, and it would be diversified and I could get in and out of it and rebalance it, etc. The value of buying a house on a mortgage is, for most people, it is the only cheap and easy way of investing some of your wealth that is otherwise completely uninvestable. It is effectively what you're investing is your human capital. You're investing the value of your own future earnings stream.
Yes.
And that is actually a very sensible thing to do. And ideally, you would do that and still buy a diversified portfolio. But unfortunately, the rules of the game don't let you do that.
No. So you have to have the house or the involved in it. True. So do you have also a story for your worst investment?
It involves currencies, and another one of my rules I have in my investment constitution is never ever take currency positions. Of course, sometimes you do by accident, but I came to the conclusion in the financial crisis that I absolutely have no ability to predict currency movements whatsoever. Personally, I doubt that anybody has that ability, but I certainly don't. And I had an investment where I had a little bit of debt in borrowing in one currency, and I thought it would be very clever to go and do what essentially was a kind of carry trade and invest it in another currency. And the asset did quite well, and the currency did very badly. And there was a long while where I didn't even realize this had happened, because I was watching the asset price and I wasn't watching the currency thing. And, you know, because your mind mentally, we simplify things by compartmentalizing. And actually, this was a sort of a combined trade, and I was losing money badly and didn't even realize it was happening for a while. So I stay away from currency trades, and generally other than mortgage from any form of leverage.
Mm. Which is a typical thing to do, because the fear, and then if we are hurt, then we just don't do it anymore. And I would normally say, if it was like in equities or in bonds, that might not be the right way to do it, because you had to look into, why did I lose money, instead of just saying, well, I lost on equities, I'm not going to touch. But with currencies, there's not necessarily any economic reason for that to rise or fall over time. I mean, different things can happen there. Not like in equities. They're going to, a portfolio of equities is going to go up over time.
Yeah. I mean, I think a good general rule is there are classes of assets that are productive assets. Equities produce dividends, you know, fixed income produces interest, even property produces rental income, etc. And there are some that are purely speculative. The value is only what someone else will pay you for it in the future. Yeah. And that includes currencies, art, all sorts of things.
Yes. Well, although art you can look at. There's an emotional return from that, yes. Might be a return from that. Do you have any good suggestions for my listeners on a book or a podcast that they can listen to or read to get to know more about investment psychology or
financial behavior? Let me think. A book. I haven't been reading a lot of actual financial or investing books of late. One that comes to mind that I really value, it's not explicitly about investing, but it is behavioral. But it's called Scarcity. And it's by Eldar Shafir and Sendhil Malainathan. But they're both, you know, very impressive behavioral academics. The whole idea of scarcity is, it's a bit like my currency thing. I had a scarcity of bandwidth, and so I wasn't watching everything at once. When we are short of things as humans, we tunnel in and we focus on that one thing that we're short of, and to the exclusion of everything else. And that can be incredibly costly. Like when, you know, you're worried about the markets going up and down, and the meanwhile, you know, forget to look after your job. They explore this notion of scarcity and how it influences our decision-making in some really, really fundamental ways. Whether you're short of time, or you're short of money, or you're short of cognitive bandwidth, these things really, really influence our decision-making, and I recommend that book highly.
Okay, I'm going to put it in the show notes so that people can find it, and I think I'm going to look into it as well. What advice would you give 25-year-old Greg Davis, if you had that possibility to go back in time on economics?
On economics, on investing, take more risk. This point about taking out a mortgage being a way of investing your human capital. When you're 25, you finished university, you know, whatever, you finished your education, you've got a job, you've got 30 or 40 years of accumulation left ahead of you. And you've built up your human capital, and the money you actually have to invest is relatively small because you haven't made very much money yet. And so what happens to that money on the downside doesn't really matter to you very much in the longer view of your life. Whereas if you put it to work and you start compounding it over the next 30 or 40 years, it can make a big long-term difference. So I really just start getting into something. It doesn't even matter what you buy. Again, put aside your little safety net, make sure you can fund a few months of expenditure, and take the rest and just put it into equities and leave it. Just leave it alone.
A diversified portfolio.
Diversified, of course.
Yes. Because, well, you might, if something happens, you might get scared of equities and say, I'm never going to invest in that anymore. The burnt child philosophy. Yeah. That was it, Greg. Thank you very much for being on my podcast.
I'm going to mail you my investment on the Brain Cup so that you can have your coffee out of that in the future.
I hope
maybe we can do this another time in the fall or another time. But thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Jens.
Du har lyttet til Investering på Hjernen. Mit navn er Jens Balle, og denne episode var redigeret af Emil Mantai.